you can't chart a path for something unless you know where you're going. The very people who are going to support this campaign at the largest level, seven-figure gifts, they understand what this process is.
There's some people that just get stuck. They're like, okay, we can't move forward.
There's legal requirements. There's regulations. So if you hesitate or you take your time and then all of a sudden you want to move fast, it can't.
We're punishing the kids. Like if it's a school, like guys.
By not being in this stunning new guys, building, what are you doing to the kids?
Exactly. If it's a $2 million project, maybe they'll give $200,000. The answer is no. If it's a $2 million project, but that's a much more attractive project, they might give $300,000.
Right.
And I said, for the sake of us helping to set the campaign goal, we would like to know if you see yourself either at a seven-figure gift level, six-figure gift level. It gives us an idea to set goal. I said, do you see yourself at a seven-figure gift level? And he said, yes.
Wow. In this episode, I sat down with Yossi Fischler, founder of Consult, and Jonah Halper, president of Altruicity. I asked them straight up questions that can benefit any organization, any yeshiva that's about to embark on any type of campaign of any size. These are people that are involved in multi-million dollar efforts. In fact, one of my questions is going to be, how do you figure out the price point of a campaign? Is it a $5 million campaign, $10, $25 million, or even greater? What are some of the issues and mindset points that need to be factored in when you're embarking on a major campaign? Who needs to be on your team, your board? How do you involve them properly? These incredible guests, Yossi Fischler, founder of Consult, he directs organizations how to strategically plan, design, and execute major building campaigns from start to finish. And Jonah Halper, president of Altruicity, where he works with nonprofit leaders to build thoughtful, sustainable fundraising campaigns. Without further ado, enjoy the Capital Campaign Playbook. Well, I've been waiting to do this show for quite some time. Welcome to Mind Your Business.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn to Yossi first. Tell us your backstory. Now you're involved in all these big campaigns. At what was it when you were five, when you were 20? Like, what was the aha moment that you got into this? And like, what's the journey like?
So you're saying exactly what happened. Since I was a little kid, always wanted to do design, always wanted to do architecture.
Okay.
Day one. Went to school for architecture.
Ah, nice.
You know, finished that and then went to a design build company for nursing homes. Was there for a short period of time. Then went to the developer. That's where I got a lot of my experience, a lot of my education. Designing, executing, building skyscrapers, nursing homes, office buildings, little houses over there also. And that, I really have a karsa tov to that person, David Marks. He was really, you know, really helpful in getting that deep education. I managed architectural firm inside, you know, helped with construction company. That really gave me the boundaries. So over there, I was VP of design and development, overseeing all this. And I saw this niche that was missing that I was taking care of in the company, but I saw it was missing in the real world, in the, you know, outside of a developer in all nonprofits or anyone who's a non-developer or even a green developer, someone who's not, you know, fluent in all this stuff starting off. I saw that there was a lot missing because owner's reps, when everyone talks about owner's reps, they're on the construction side, 99.9% on the construction side. On the design side, there's really no one that pulls it all together. So that's where Consult came from. And it was really sort of a light bulb for people, for myself, that this was really needed. And we manage, execute design from A to Z, from before you have an idea, programmatic design, hiring the architects, interior designers, critiquing all that design, dealing with very complicated projects, demapping streets, assemblages of properties, phasing of buildings.
When was it founded?
It was founded about 12 years ago.
Nice.
So it really brought a new era of responsibility, of design, of execution, and truly confidence to all these leaders that they have someone to really lean on through the entire process up until construction. And when Amazing. You get to construction, it's awesome.
Amazing. Now we turn to Jonah. First of all, lucky Jonah. You live in?
I live in Ramat Beit Shemesh in Israel.
Ramat Beit Shemesh.
Yes.
He's here. It's special. He's here in the States. Tell us about your journey.
Wow. Okay. I'll go way back.
Because
I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island.
Nice.
And when you grow up in a small community, And you see how your father and your family and other families kind of build community together, that you can't just kind of plug in. There's not much there unless you make it into something. I was always inspired, and I decided my career should be in community building of some kind. I wanted to work for the Jewish community. I had no interest in being a pulpit rabbi or in clay Kodesh like that, but I did feel like I wanted to be involved in some kind of organizational development, and I went to school for it. I have my bachelor's in organizational communications, my master's is in public administration, and I just went down that road of saying, okay, like I want to be involved in helping people who have great ideas and great vision for great organizations, great projects, and I want to help them sustain and grow. So I always said I don't have original ideas of my own. I like to help other people take their brilliant ideas, their vision, and make them sustainable and for the long term. And I've built my career around that. I worked in the Federation system, the Federation in Baltimore and Northern New Jersey for the better part of 10 years. And then in 2010, when I started paying day school tuition and I was like, this whole Jewish nonprofit thing isn't going to cut it, I was like, how do I stay in the space? Because I love it. I love what I was doing. How do I stay in the space, but make more of a living? And because of my wife, and I give all the credit to my wife, because I am incredibly risk averse. My personality is risk averse. Mm-hmm. And she said, you need to go start your own thing. You need to start a consulting firm. And in 2010, so this is 16 years ago now, I started Altruicity, which is my my fundraising strategy and project management firm. And in the early days, I was thinking it'll be more like a marketing firm, maybe more in like your neck of the woods as far as the work is concerned. But I really quickly realized that my skills that I had built over the first 10 years of my career was in bringing in new donors to an organization, building a sustainable base of donors and leadership in an organization, and that's really where I should be spending my energies. So I started building a firm, and when you're a kid, when you start building a consulting firm, I was turning 30 years old, now I'm 45. By the time I was 30, and why hire a 30-year-old kid when you go hire someone who's got 30 plus years of professional experience? So my angle, my unique selling proposition had to be, what can I bring to the table that is unique to someone who's young, full of vim and vigor? Like, what can
right.
I bring?
Right.
And that was the project management, to say, we're not just going to be what you would find as typical armchair consultants. We're going to be a firm that's focused on building a strategy, but also coupling it with a strategic, project management, to say, how do we execute this to the end? Because good ideas don't fail because they're not good ideas. They fail because they're not properly implemented. So we're breaking it apart into project tasks, deadlines, what professional staff's doing, what lay leadership is doing. And to this day, we now have a team of over 10 professionals. I am in Israel, as you mentioned. I live in Israel, but most of my team is U.S. stateside. We're an East Coast company, and we do annual campaigns, capital campaigns, endowment campaigns. And as the topic of today being capital campaigns, this year, we're doing 9 capital campaigns, totaling. I mean, if you aggregate like all the goals, it's like over $200 million.
Special.
That's some real impact that we're able to make. So, that's a little bit about me.
Amazing. Now, the questions we've curated a number of really great questions that have to do with a yeshiva, an organization, a shul, of any size, as it relates to major campaigns. The questions will sometimes first go to Jonah, first go to Yossi, but everyone feel free to chime in, because I'm first going to start with Jonah.
Oh,
on this one.
Man, trial by fire.
All right. Fire, ready, aim. Let's talk about this. Yeah. There are people that look before they leap. There are people that leap before they look.
Yeah.
Talk about if a strategy is not in place, but they leap right in. They're ambitious. They want to climb the mountain. They're ready. You don't want to slow them down either. But at the same time, there's no sof ma'aseh machshava v'tchila in place. Like, all right, how does that work?
Right. So first of all, my personality is someone who's just put their foot on the gas pedal. So
okay.
I it's funny because I of course I'm going to tell you that strategic planning is integral to the success of any campaign, but that's also kind of counter my
right,
natural
your
state.
Own,
I'm someone
how
who's
you're
just
wired.
Like, let's just do it. Let's see what happens. Let's go. Now, that may work if it's a matter of conquering a fear and saying, okay, let me just like, just not think about it and like public speak
and
run in. But when you're talking about something that's multifaceted and there's a lot of people involved and there's a lot at stake, you have to have that clarity going in advance. I mean, the idea of saying like, we're just going to dive right in and not have clarity. Like, well, first of all, start off, what's the vision? Like, where are you headed? Right. You can't chart a path for something unless you know where you're going. Yeah. So on a very basic level, you have to have clarity. Like what that does that vision look like? What does that kind of full dream look like? No matter what you're doing. Right. So that has to be in place. And then you could start reverse engineering to say, well, if we want that full dream, what do we need to have in place? Now, I come from the development side. I'm thinking in terms of what do we need in order to raise the most amount of money where all the stakeholders and leadership feel involved,
engaged,
they're engaged and they have a place. But I'm not on the operational side. I'm not on the building side. So, you know, I have this fantastic tension where I'm like, OK, well, I can give you the structure on the development side, but I can't give you I'm not the expert. Like I know where my arm length is. Like I know what I can advise on. But when it comes to a building project, whether it's a shul or a school, I'm not going to be able to tell them, okay, this is how you reverse engineer the full dream on the project side. So usually I will tell them, come to me when you have some level of clarity. And the way I tell them is like, when you're at the level where you can create dedication opportunities, because in my mind, if they have already synthesized what they're doing on a project, like they have clarity, that full dream, and able to reverse engineer to the point where they can basically itemize the things that they have within the space and say, now let's put prices to it. Because then I can say, okay, now you're giving me a product to work with. So really that's how I think about it, is saying, what's the full dream? Is the first question I always ask, because a lot of times when someone comes to me and says, hey, we need a building campaign, and I ask them, how much do you need to raise? And they'll say, we need to raise $20 million. I'm like, great. Why $20 million?
Right. Right, all right. Is that just a number out of the hat, or is a plan for that?
So usually there's like thinking, okay, either it's building purchase, renovations, you know, all the hard costs associated with it. They might be thinking in terms of, you know, maybe operating, what it costs to run the campaign,
soft costs.
But in the end of the day, they're not necessarily including everything. You don't get to do a capital campaign every year, like annual campaign is annual by definition. Annual. So if you screw it up, right, you can always go next year.
But it's interesting that what you said, because you want a vision, but how far do you wait for them to go to say how much money it is? Because at a certain point, they're going to say, let's say it's 20 million. And they designed a little bit, and then you go back to them and say, I don't think you can make 20 million.
Right.
So then you have to start cutting back. So the question is, where's that fine line of how much design you have to do, how much thought you have to put in before they go to you and say, okay, this is the general idea. We have some renderings, we have some design. This is what we think it's going to cost.
Yep.
Could we raise this before they go too far? And then they come to you and say, okay, this is going to cost 20 million. And then you go back to them and say, you really can only, you know, pull 15 million on this project. You got to go back to the drawing board, and it's too far along. So how do you balance that?
Okay. So first of all, anytime we're doing a capital campaign, the first step we're doing is something called a feasibility study. Our firm doesn't like to call feasibility study because it sounds like an academic exercise, like a spiraled ring report that you give to them and it sits on it collects dust. Like, yeah, that's not what it is. It's a very intentional process that engages the very people you're going to ultimately solicit. So it's a really great way to engage at an early stage the people who are going to be carrying a lot of this campaign on their shoulders. In fact, like 75 to 80% of all the dollars raised is coming from the people that you're involving at this stage, which is a major, major thing. So what you're saying is like, how do you know if the full dream is even attainable?
You're not waiting for that donor list. In the building, like you're not waiting for all the mezuzah accounts and all the door frames and everything to decide what you could raise. You're talking about rendering stage, schematic drawings.
And there's no shame. If we're doing that process and we're engaging the leadership and we're interviewing the top 25 donors who can carry this campaign, and we see that, you know what, $20 million is not reasonable. It's more like $15 million or $12 million. Then they're able to make smart decisions early before they've already gone too far in. And the donors appreciate it. In fact, when they go through this exercise, remember, the very people who are going to support this campaign at the largest level, seven-figure gifts, like, you know, the $1 million level, the hundreds of thousands of dollars, they understand what this process is to say, We don't want to just put our foot on the gas pedal. And wouldn't you be happier to know that we've interviewed all the people who can really carry this campaign and see that we need to adjust the campaign goal
to finish the project,
to do the project, or even to say we can't have the plan A version. We're going to have to come with a plan B version. And they'll appreciate that to say you've now made a decision that is not knee jerk. You know, you didn't just handicap the project. We're doing the new full dream, which is now the plan B. Correct. So that's really the goal of it, is to engage them early. So they're, the famous line from Dale Carnegie is people support a world they help to create. So the idea of going to donors and say, we need to involve you in this stage of the process. And then they see what's going on. You're letting them see underneath the hood. I don't want them to see how the sausage is made in completion. Sometimes they don't need to know too much, but for them to be involved at this stage is invaluable. And then you don't have cross wires. Donors don't feel like they've been bait and switched on the project. Like, well, I gave you $1 million thinking the project's going to look like this, but now it looks like this. You've involved them from the beginning.
Yeah, this is important synergy. I know it's a cliche word here, but it's important because there are times that people have the donor consultant or the donor idea separate from the design and construction process. They're not synced up, and one goes too far or one doesn't go far enough, and then they meet too late, and then either the donor side has to pull back, the donor consultant side, or the design side has to pull back to match up. So meeting up earlier and syncing up is very important.
And Yitzhak, I would imagine, even in your world, if this doesn't happen properly, when you have to kind of turn it into something that is a case or materials to say, this is the project. If they don't have this done, they're probably not going to have clarity. You know, and you have to ask them the questions, right? I mean, I imagine what's your process look like?
You'll have a lot of empty slots.
No. So it's a fair question. As it relates to a capital building campaign, so the marketing approach is, and that's why even when we spec it out, when we quote it out to clients, is that there's two separate aspects. One is a proactive campaign, and one is the capital campaign, the relationship fundraising brochure. And because at the beginning, we're kind of feeling our way, it's wet clay for the first 6 months, for the first year, I usually advise them, don't launch a proactive campaign. Only focus on that brochure, because that brochure will give you the tool to then go to your major donors to solicit, to present the dream to them. And then you have an idea. Once that's all clear, then launch to the public. But it's rare that a client is ready to launch a proactive campaign to the public. And that's why I usually tell them, focus on that brochure first.
Yeah, that's actually consistent with best practices on our side in capital campaigns, because the process is you do the feasibility study, and then you launch a quiet phase of the capital campaign. That's
with your top relationships.
Top seven and six figure gift solicitations. And that's going to take a little bit of time, right? To coordinate
that's
those meetings.
12 months.
We've had the fastest we've ever done was 7 months. That's the fastest we've ever
done. But it's also important what you're saying, that a quiet campaign, because in that situation, you could have renderings that are not exactly what the building is going to look like. You could have the drawings that this is a concept, this is ideas, and those people at that level, they understand you're not there yet.
Yeah.
You're still, as you say, molding the clay.
Right. Okay. So that we talked just now about fire ready aim. Let's go to the other side, and I'll turn this to Yossi first. There is a concept called paralysis by analysis. It's okay. So you want to, on one hand, what's your vision? What's your dream? Chart it out from the beginning. But at the same time, there's some people that just get stuck. They're like, you got to cross the T's and dot the I's. Okay, I don't have every last one dotted. Okay, we can't move forward. So then you come back a year later, 2 years later, and the foundation is still a piece of land. Nothing's happening. What is the balance?
So it's very interesting. I'm going to answer this probably not the way you think I'm going to answer this.
Already, that's.
I don't think there's analysis paralysis. Okay. I think that there's the people like we just talked about that, okay, this is good enough. Let's start. And then they're tripping their whole way through. Either they don't have the money lined up, they don't have the full design team lined up, the design is not correct, they're ever changing with change orders or switching architects or whatever it is on that side, that they just jump too fast. So they don't have the clarity. The other side is people that don't focus on it. It's not that they're analyzing it too much And they're like, okay, I have to wait until everything's perfect. Okay. I actually find that it's people that don't focus on the product. They like start and they're focusing, then they stop. Then 2 months later, they're focusing again, and then they stop. So they don't.
What's making them stop?
They're have jobs. They're volunteers and they have jobs, oh, okay. Or even in their job as executive director or other things.
But to pick up on Jonah saying, it's not because they ran out of cash flow or like.
No, I don't think it's cash flow. I think it's a little more focused that on a project, such a large project, you have to focus continuously because right. You're going to lose morale.
Yeah, momentum
yeah. from everyone around you, yeah. And people are not going to think you're serious. Right. So I think it's a little less analysis paralysis because I don't think I've come across someone that I'm not starting until I have everything perfect. Maybe one person I've had that I want all the money in the bank. I want all the design 100% done. I'm not starting because of so usually the pressure to start from the board, right. From clientele, or the pressure
and the pressure of the need.
Right, exactly.
If it's a school and they
I don't have any more seats. I have a new class coming in next year or 2 years. I got my early childhood has extra class already. By the time it gets to elementary, I got to have room for them. Right. So there's pressure to start from that. But the analysis paralysis is interesting because you would think that would be the case. I really don't have that.
Okay. A client comes with their dream. They want to jump in. The flip side of fire ready aim. You know, like what is the potential danger of someone like just getting too, if I may, I'm just going to hold on to the paralysis by analysis mindset.
Yeah. I mean, we do see aspects of it to some degree. I think we do see, like, as we were talking before, more people jumping right in. But I think if you give people, I think it's a general rule in marketing, if you give people too many options, then they have a hard time making a decision. I think that when I start seeing things move slow down or decision making that's taking too long, there's a very easy way to short circuit that to get back on track is you remind them what the big vision here is. You know, like we're punishing the kids. Like if it's a school, like guys,
by not being in this stunning new guys, building, what are you doing to the kids?
Exactly. Like I know everyone's here is busy. We have to reconvene. We have to make some decisions here. You know, these kids need a place or, you know, whatever the program, if it's a synagogue, you know, this place is a dump, you know, you need a tetanus shot just to walk in here. Like we need something better. Guys, come on. Let's sometimes just reminding them that like, it's easy to get caught up in the details. We're all busy. And as Jesse made a good point, a lot of people who are involved in these projects are volunteers. They're lay leaders. Right. They have day jobs. So you're working in evening hours. You're working in times that are not convenient for everybody. But at the same time, we have to rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. And as long as we remind people what the ultimate goal is again, like, guys, remember, why are we doing this? And then they go, okay. Let's just buckle down and make a decision. So that way you're not humoring it, whatever the analysis is. If you've got them too many options or whatever, what's going on, right. It's like, guys, just let's decide something. And I think in general, like I treat this with my own family, my own kids. Like I have a child who will say to me, I don't know if this is the right decision or that's the right decision. Another one. And I'll say, you make the best decision with information you have, right? The best you can, then you've chosen it. That's it. Right. That's it. You run. And then you own it. That's it. And now you operate with that. The trinity of regret, coulda, shoulda, woulda, right? Like, we don't want to be in that world, right? Like you can easily be someone who gets stuck in the mud in that way. But the answer is you make decisions. You make the best decision with the information you have and weiter. Like just let's go.
I do want to add one thing. The difference between Jonah and myself, and correct me if I'm wrong. No. And our approach is that with a building versus a capital campaign, any building, even a house, there's legal requirements. There's regulations. That's true, yeah. So if you hesitate or you take your time and then all of a sudden you want to move fast, it can't. You have to file stuff. You have to get approvals.
So many things that have to line up.
And not all of them could run at the same time. Yes, we have 10 trains running at the same time usually, but some are linear. And if you wait for this approval to get this approval and then this approval to get that permit, and the earlier you start, the faster you start, the more attention you pay to it, it's different versus if someone walks over and you says, here's 100 million, you're done.
Right. And I can tell you, I've experienced that. We've had clients that have gone on hiatus for like 6 months or longer because like, oh, we need certain zoning in place and we don't have it. Right. And we're like, okay, so we're sitting there twiddling our thumbs. There's literally nothing that we could do. We can't give them any advice to help them with this piece of it. That's squarely in Yossi's department.
Coming back to the previous discussion, just a little bit about my own background. I went to FIT. But the greatest blessing that I had in my career development was I worked for art school for 3 years, Rav Meir Zlotowitz. And there's a great line that's attributed to him that really is so apropos here. He said, "What did Ravina say to Ravashi? We got to go to print." Now, the reason why that's, I love using that line, again, it's attributed to Rav Meir Zlotowitz, that's all, is that at the end of the day, you got to move forward. Art Scroll puts out amazing products, and Rav Meir Zlotowitz was a perfectionist. He's a perfectionist. Right. He really demanded perfection. Yet at the same time, a Gemara that was on the timeline of Daf Yomi had to be produced for the cycle of Daf Yomi. That's it.
Right.
You got to go to print. So now, yeah, have the team in place to make sure that it's as perfect as can be, et cetera. Don't, you know, cross the T's, dot the I's. But at the same time, the train's got to leave the station.
And also, I would imagine, even in the case of Art School, which is so perfect and so meticulous, there are multiple editions because they make changes and fixes along the way.
You have to draw a line in the sand and say, we're going.
We got to do this.
Right.
Nothing is ever going to be perfect, and we could always correct it, hopefully.
Yep. And when strategic planning for a capital building campaign or a crowdfunding campaign or any type of major fundraising initiative is skipped or rushed, what are the consequences?
Oh, boy.
We could be here all day.
Or some examples, you know.
I mean, here's the thing. When skipped or rushed, I sit in the 20,000-foot view. So I know what the implications are. Most people, when they're doing something in a rushed fashion, let's say rushed, for example, they'll come finish the campaign and say, we were successful. But what they don't know is how much they left on the table, right? And it's just because you were able to hit a campaign goal doesn't mean that had you had an extra few months to do things properly, your campaign might have been, you know.
I mean, the goal was too low. Ask was too low.
Yeah, I see so many campaigns where, you know, especially like crowdfunding campaigns and things that are like an anchored fundraising experience that happens each year. And you'd think that if it happens each year, like maybe we could finally get it where, you know, you start early enough. But invariably, there's always bouncing from one fire to another. So I could tell you so many examples of when we finally sat down with a client and said, okay, let's try this a little differently. Let's start doing this 3-4 months in advance. And we want to incorporate X, Y, because we're not going to come in and just give them the same experience that they had, like that whatever they did the year before. Like, we're not here to just replicate what they've done. So we want to take it to the next level. We want more time, and we're going to incorporate things that are going to be new that will bring in more revenue into the organization. And hopefully if it's cemented properly, this becomes systems and habits that they're going to incorporate now moving forward, even once we've, you know, exited stage left. And in every one of those cases, without fail, anytime that we've been involved, they'll come back and say, like, we didn't realize like that there's so much more that could be done. Beautiful. Right? Like, it's the idea of like, you don't know what you don't know. And in this case, there's so many great examples of where someone got a gift from somebody that was 100% more than they thought it was going to be. And they would have been fine with the amount that they gave last year because they thought that was the threshold.
I want to add to that. I'm living that now. Before I answer the question directly, we have a client that we're designing a building for, and we're limiting certain parts of it or value engineering it because they feel they could collect a certain amount. And because as experience, you know, grows, I'm asking them, so where are you getting that from? Are you tapping this audience? Are you tapping this audience? Why do you think that? Because technically you're stunting your building design and you're stunting your permanence, because now your building won't have certain features or it'll be smaller, or you know, for future growth, you're not going to have a room that you wanted to have. So therefore, that's where Jonah comes in to help them expand their horizons and think out of the box of how much money, because it is a domino effect that if you think you only could get this, then automatically you're going to assume you only could build this. And therefore, your programs are limited to this. Right. And it's a domino effect all the way through.
Established a low ceiling.
Correct.
And it's interesting because I think a lot of times people do lower their expectations because they think like, this is all that my donors are going to have the appetite for. And what happens is, you know, if I would come somebody and say, it's $1 million project and I'm going to get from this person $100,000. So you might say, if it's a $2 million project, maybe they'll give $200,000. The answer is no. If it's a $2 million project, but that's a much more attractive project, they might give $300,000, $400,000,
$500,000. I've seen that in many campaigns. That's correct.
Right.
Building to their vision, to their dream, the amount that you could secure from a major donor by exciting them properly is many times more
No one wants incremental growth. Right. They want to see something that's transformative. And that is what gets people excited. That's what they salivate over. They're like, I want some of that. Like, how do we do that? Like some of the biggest projects that we know in philanthropy in the last decade, like think about Birthright, right? We're going to send every child, every Jewish child to Israel. That's a crazy vision. Like every kid, do you know how much it costs to do that? But the millionaires and the billionaires who got behind that project, they're like, that's something that excites me. Because that's something that we can sink our teeth into. And if we could figure out a path on how to facilitate that, that's transformative. So yeah, so if we can start thinking, especially for our own shuls, our own schools, and say, what does like some crazy, big, hairy, audacious goal look like for us in, whether it's in wholesale or something specific, what we're doing, if we're a school, right? What would mean another $1 million that if we invested it in academic excellence or in Midos or in, you know, if your school that's a more Eretz Yisrael Zionism school, like what does that look like? A more immersive experience there, right? What can you do to make donors more excited about that than to just like, okay, well, we want to pay our teachers, you know, another 10%, or want to offer this. And you're like, okay, so you need more money because you're making incremental change. Like you might get some more money, but it's not going to get people excited. So you have to, the bigger vision.
Right. So, I'm going to chime in for right.
This really relates to your work.
Correct. Because for me, there's something that we do on, and to the nth degree is programmatic and analytical design. So people look at that and see it's just a bunch of words. But in reality, a lot of people start projects, and we've picked up projects like this that they sit down with an architect and or you know other design professionals, and they say, I want this. I want 7 classrooms. I need an auditorium. I need, you know, a lunchroom. But it's a one pager at most. So we go through. We ask thousands of questions, but we don't only ask the top tier people. We don't just ask the executive director or the board members or the principal. We speak with security. We speak with whoever runs the kitchen. We speak with the maintenance guy. We speak with a handful of teachers. A big one that we speak to is resource and enrichment, because that is overlooked how much space they need and how the space is actually laid out, whether throughout the school or one center. So there's different thought processes to that. We speak to the person in the front, the secretary, who's really orchestrating a lot in the building, how parents are coming
really
in.
Really knows the flow. Yes. And
students, dismissal and arrival, we speak to people that run that. You know, also we speak to not only the people that are in the building, but who's coming into the building. We speak to, you know, whether it's deliveries, whether it is parents, whether it's donors, whether it is, you know, not only
teacher staff,
everything. Where are they coming? The front door, the back door? Where are they signing in? The students, do you want that when you walk into the lobby, it's quiet? And then the students are behind security and the craziness of a school, which is awesome, but it's over there. And then also, let's say a parent has to come in because their child is not doing well for whatever reason. Do you want them to be paraded and everyone see them come in? Or do you want like a nice side door that they go straight to the principal's office? So there's a lot of different things. So we do the programmatic design. It takes, you know, sometimes it takes a few weeks, sometimes it takes a few months. It really depends on the operation, how complex it is. And then we create spreadsheets of every employee in the organization, including every board member, every last person that is visiting that building. And also we create a room list. One interesting tidbit is that we were doing this for a school and we were reviewing the resource and enrichment. We found out that in one room, it was only used a half hour a day because there was no analysis of who's coming, who's going, who's using what. Right arm was not talking to the left arm. It really wasn't laid out. If you skip that on a project, you are forever changing the design. Your rooms are too small, on the wrong floor. The adjacencies are incorrect. You're missing rooms. You're just going to have unhappy people and a building that is not working for you. You're trying to, you know, shoehorn into a building. So I would say that is ultimate more than anything, because that one tagline that we have, besides that we prevent the coulda, woulda, shoulda, which is what you're talking about before, is we sell confidence. Once you have that and you start designing, to your donors, to your board member, to the bank, to everyone, I'm confident this is what we want and this is what we need. Will we modify it as we design the project based on dollars, based on fitting on the property, based on zoning? Of course, 10%. Not keep on changing and changing and changing, which will cost you money and time and frustration. So that's, you know,
and I've seen when you have schools that are like a hodgepodge of like additions and expansions where there's none of that intentional work being done. If a school doesn't think that this impacts their admissions and ability to get kids in the school, they're like it's incredible. Because if a parent comes in to check out a school and they see a place that's intentional, whether they even can even vocalize what it is that they love about it or not, or, you know, it's there. And therefore it has real implications on your ability to grow a school in a smart way, because when you walk into a place that feels like, it looks like a hodgepodge, it feels like a hodgepodge. And therefore the person's like, oh, this place is a balagan. Like, I'm not sure this is the right place for our kids. Like, there is a end user experience that they're now going to have that will have an implication on your ability
right.
to
succeed. So some people, you can throw out the word feng shui, right?
Yeah.
That when you walk into a place and it just flows from next to next, and we're not talking only schools, we're talking about shuls. You know, we do a lot of houses as well. So we apply the same philosophy to that. So when any end user, like you're saying, if a student knows where they're supposed to go from end to end because it flows, whether it's the bathroom or the lunchroom mm-hmm. or when they first come in or to the playground. And in a shul, you know, a stranger comes in and goes, where's the shul? Where's the bathrooms? Where's the itzer? Where's, how do I get in? How do I get? All those things are very important for the end user, like you're saying, and in a house also, obviously. But in a commercial setting, it's very important.
Are there any stories that come to mind, any incidents where like, uh-oh, we forgot to involve someone that cost us a major gift, or how could we are kicking ourselves afterwards, or the fact that we involved Mr. A or Mrs. B, whatever it is, whatever the case may be, it was like, wow, that resulted in either a great gift.
So I'll say two things. One is a piece of advice I got early in my career, and then I'll share the story. One of the first things, when I worked in the Federation system, and I started my career at the Associated, the Jewish Community Federation of Baltimore, in Baltimore, Maryland. And there was a lay leader who was, I believe, the chair of the women's division. Like in the Federation world, like this women's philanthropy that they give separately from their husbands, they give as a woman. So there was a woman there, and her name was Linda Hurwitz. She's now a much more of a high profile on the national scene. But she gave me the best advice. She said to me, Jonah, you're going to be staffing your first committee. You're going to be having your first committee. And let me give you a piece of advice. When you have lay leaders involved in a committee setting, if you give them a good experience, right, mm-hmm. then they take a step forward. It's like furthering their involvement, their engagement. But if you waste their time, all right. If they're rubber stamping,
right.
If you don't give them anything meaningful to do, it's just like a feather in the cap for the organization. Like, oh, look at our fancy people who are on our committee, right? That's going to take two steps or maybe even more steps back for that person. So it's very important that if you're involving lay leadership, that you do it with you know, gusto and intention, and you're giving them something meaningful to do. And don't be afraid to do it, because you might say like, oh, you know, they're busy. They're like a millionaire or a billionaire. Ask them to roll up their sleeves. Right. It might be in a formal way or an informal way, but give them something meaningful to do and they will thank you. They'll say, wow, this was I'm glad I was able to really make a difference. If they're just there to, you know, eat the pan of penne that they're serving you at the board meeting. Right. Then that's not a good use of your time. So that's a piece of advice that I got, which I carry through. And anytime there's lay leadership involvement, I take that very, very seriously. The other thing I would say is, you know, when you talk about before launching, and you're going through all these leadership solicitations, and you're having these conversations mm-hmm. in advance before you ask. Mm-hmm. We have a client in Chicago, and it's a school, and they had a tenant that is another institution in there. I don't want to give too much information. Right. I'm going to give it all away. Right. Especially, you know, our Jewish community is very small. Everyone knows everybody. So they had a tenant. And this tenant is another nonprofit, and they wanted to solicit for the capital campaign. The school is going to do a capital campaign, a key lay leader of that tenant organization, because they're in the space. They know them. And this lay leader is a very, very wealthy nursing home owner. That's not a surprise. The Chicago nursing home owners. And they wanted to go to him for money. And they were like, they're saying, OK, what's the projection that we're going to ask for $100,000? That's what we're going to aim for, because some of the people who are more loosely connected at that level is probably going to be at the 100K level. So I go in to have this interview with him before the project starts, and he's clearly a community leader and someone involved. And at the end of my questions, I ask them, it's not a solicitation, but I say, do you see yourself participating in this campaign, right? Testing the appetite.
Right, right.
And he said, yes. And I said, for the sake of us helping to set the campaign goal, we would like to know if you see yourself either at a seven-figure gift level, six-figure gift level. It gives us an idea to set goal. I said, do you see yourself at a seven-figure gift level? And he said, yes.
Wow.
So I
you got yourself 900K.
900K. And had we not asked that question, the client would have been happy with the 100,000.
Right.
They would have walked away. Yeah, we did it. Crazy. We did it. So just asking the question, do you see yourself giving at a seven-figure level? If these would have said no,
then fine.
Then we said, okay, six-figure. And would you be comfortable sharing the range?
That right. Kind of, okay. Right. Half a million.
I actually, when that call was over, it was a Zoom video with him. And when the call was over, I actually went to the script afterwards. I was like, I must have misheard. Like, there's no way. Like there's,
wow.
Yeah. So
amazing.
Yeah. So I went to the client. I said, this is why we involve leadership early and often, right? It's an opportunity to see what you're dealing with. And that was a wonderful example. And sometimes it cuts the other way. If sometimes it's like, oh, it's not a seven-figure gift. Sometimes it's a five-figure gift. And you're like, oh my God, I thought this was going to come in way higher. At least now you're able to plan accordingly.
Incredible. You want to tackle this one?
Yes. It's very interesting. Because to have board members in the beginning and lay leaders is very important on a project. First of all, a lot of the board members either are professionals in the field of real estate and things like that.
And they're familiar themselves.
Correct. And then in addition, usually if someone's on a board, he's on six other boards. So they have a lot of insight and a lot of just really deep down insight on how to make a project successful. You know, when the cadence of it, you know, to make sure that it keeps moving, the crescendo at the end, that it's, you know, that it's successful. They don't want to be on a board or on a project of a failing project, right?
That's for sure.
You know, especially, you know, right. And the donor, if someone pledges 2 million or 10 million, they want to know that's going to happen. They don't want everyone to know that they pledged 10 million and then the project failed.
Oh, no.
Right. So it's very important that it's designed well, executed well. So in the beginning, yes, it's very important to have the board members, executive directors, you know, presidents, whoever's involved in there. But, and then building committees and everyone. But what I've seen is as projects go on, they tend to fall away because they want the people to run it who are supposed to run it. What I would say is that the communication between the board members and the executive directors has to be consistent because there are times that board members come back into the picture and are like, what? We're doing this? Why are we doing this? So we want to make sure that even though in the beginning we want them, we don't want too many cooks throughout the project.
Right.
We want to have them in there, have the insight. Also, sometimes we present every few months, you know, this is what we're up to. Here are the renderings, here are the drawings. Let me walk you through any comments. So it's a concentrated effort, intentional effort to keep them involved. And if they have any comments versus, you know, blowing in and out. And it's very important to have one person at the helm making all the decisions. That, whether it's an executive director or if someone's hired just for the project, it's very important that only one person, even if other people are on calls, that's right. Great, but it's one person making the decision. We've had some projects where it's not, and it's been clarified and everything's worked out, but there were some shaky times where there wasn't one person and therefore things go back and forth. And that costs money and that costs time.
Right.
And also, if someone is not educated in the design field and they want to make a decision and it costs money, but then they don't know the budget, they don't know the timeline. So it's very important to do that. So there's different times for everything to make sure everyone's happy and we get to the final, you know, place properly.
The only other thing I'll give is a piece of advice on managing lay leadership is because a lot of our times the lay leaders can be strong personalities.
Right? Correct.
So, you know, yes, they may be experts, but they will let you know that they're an expert. So one of the pieces of advice that I always say is that you never go into a committee meeting without knowing the results of that meeting in advance. Right. So the way you do that is you have like back channel conversations with the people who are on that committee before you even walk in the room.
So smart.
I want to know what you're thinking. I hear them out because I'm the staff person. I'm the person, I'm the professional. I'm listening to what they have to say. And I'm then hopefully going to convey what my ideas are. I have an idea where on the wall I want to get to. And I need them to have that buy-in because the last thing you want to do is get in the room. Someone is like a loose cannon on a rolling deck and then they throw something out there and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, where did my meeting go? Like this is now like totally a departure from what we need. And it derails everything and they don't know what they're talking about. And now everyone's like, yeah, that's a good idea. And like, you know, the whole thing's falling apart. I need to know before I walk in that room, you know, and it sounds like it's manipulative.
No.
Like I know where on the wall I want to get to. How we get there is open for negotiation, but I know that I need to make sure that there is clarity as a professional. I know what's best from a technical standpoint. So I know where we need to go, but how we do that, I'm not the expert. Like I'm a GPS system. I'm recalculating to get to to the final destination, but you have to know before you even walk in the room.
So it's good advice. And I would even add that if the board members are not in the loop, then they think that the project should have been done a year ago. Like, yeah. Where are we? Or the money should have been raised a year ago, or why this? So it's very important to have a meeting with whatever party every few months, saying, this is where we're at. This is our projected schedule. This is, you know, different things that they should know, so they're not totally out of the loop. So when they hear something, they're not like, weren't we supposed to start 6 months ago? Or wasn't this supposed to be 4 floors, or now it's 3 floors, or a thousand other things that come into play. So I would push for that.
I know on this show, again, titled The Capital Campaign Playbook, we're sharing some secrets. I'll share a secret here from, you know, we're being on the front lines in terms of marketing from here at Bottom Line Marketing Group. There are times when, let's say there's a campaign concept that was, we worked along with the executive director, director of development, and a couple of key people, and then it's being presented to an entire board. Now, I usually will encourage our key point person at, let's say, the school to make sure, not a plant, but make sure that you have someone on your board who's got your back. Because sometimes you get into that room, I love the way Jonah put it, you know what you need to know before you go in so that you could already project the outcome. That's so important. Said sometimes these things can suddenly start roll off the rail. One person will come and say, I don't like it. Why? I don't know. So have someone, but yet the executive director is going to be in a defensive position. Have someone on the board who's got your back, who's not a stud. He really believes in what was presented. He's okay with it. But just in order to steer a conversation in a room with 10, very strong personalities, you know, to make sure that everything moves forward.
You just mentioned, like, you know, the fact that we should have their back. It's another very important nuance, because in every case that they've hired our firm, and I would imagine it's your case too, is that we are now the person who is like the expert coming from the outside, right? Right. Like we're paying them good money. They're coming in and they're saying, this is how it's supposed to be done. So if the executive director is getting heat, there's always the opportunity for that executive director to go, these are the experts. This is what they're telling us, right? They're giving us the guidance. They're telling us what
we hired the professional, and this is what.
Right. So there's a kind of like a self-preservation aspect that any executive director who has a board involved is saying, like, these are some big decisions we're making. So you're not offloading responsibility, but what you are doing is you're offloading the expertise to somebody who is the expert. And that does create a dynamic that's actually healthy, where the executive director doesn't become the scapegoat or the bullseye for all the ire of a decision made. If we make a bad decision, it comes on to us, right? So that's good for the executive director.
Right. Communication is key. It's just, I can't even tell you. It's important that everyone's kept in the loop, but on the sidelines, you know, but kept in the loop.
We now go to an interesting question, and that is, many times for the services that we're providing, there is a donor or a number of donors that see the vision and understand that there's a professional side of it and even pay our fee. They write out the check, as opposed to it coming from the operating of the organization. This happens in many cases. Question is, what have you seen, let's say, from those major donors? Do they appreciate, let's say, the value of what a firm brings to the table in terms of the consulting and building out the vision, even though it comes at a price tag? Or are they like, no, you know, cost is everything, and just, guys, figure it out, watch a couple of YouTube videos and just get going? And like, why do we need to pay for consultants?
I mean, anyone who's worth, any board member or a lay leader who is sophisticated on any level, I mean, they run their own business or they're, you know, in any executive position, will say that I will only get behind this project if I see it's professionally done. So if they see that you're taking the measures to do things thoughtfully and strategically, then they'll say, okay, I'm not throwing my money into a black hole. So that without a question, I've experienced that. I have experienced people the other direction saying, cut costs at all costs. But those people are tend to be less sophisticated and less understanding, right, and hopefully less influential. You don't want to be someone who's confident and stupid. The worst combination is to be confident and stupid, right? So I know it sounds a little crude, but the point is like, you know, we want the people to be confident and sophisticated and understanding and intelligent, and therefore say that this is the right thing to do. But yeah, it's I think it's clear.
And of course, I'm going to turn to Yossi, especially in your case. Imagine, you know, a school might say, listen, I have an interior design firm, I have an architect, and I have someone who specializes in permits. Like, why do I need consults?
So it's a good question. There's a few pieces to the answer, a few parts to the answer. So first of all, it's not only for donors, even for financial institutions that are lending money. I've been on a lot of bank calls. Because they ask a lot of questions and everyone goes, okay, Yossi, where we're up to on that? What's that square footage of that? What's the cost of that? What's the timeline for that? So the bank usually has that confidence. Okay, someone's watching the pot here over here. Someone's understanding what's going on. It's not a free for all. So it's not only donors that feel that way. It's financial institutions. And then also it's parents, right? They know there's someone watching everything. The second part to it is and this is why I have a Parnassa, is that when you have an executive director come in, right? Mm-hmm. So you have an architect give drawings, you have an interior designer, everyone focuses on those main people.
Right.
There are 25 more people involved in a project. Let's say we're doing variances. So there's a real estate attorney, a real estate consultant, a traffic consultant, environmental consultant. You go to hearings. Then you also have complicated projects. We've demapped streets. We've put a square block together, many, many properties that we've put together for assemblages. We have buildings that are touching each other and you have to deal with fire department access. It's endless complications. Wow. So as an executive director, you have a job to do, right? You have to run a school from all aspects. You have your maintenance and your fundraising and your parents and your schedules and everything you have to do. And then an architect gives you these drawings and says, here. And you're like, I guess it's okay. I don't know how to read drawings, but I mean, you show me what you did. Maybe I'm a visual. So here's a rendering and it looks all fancy and good. And then same with interior designer, but millwork, low voltage, Sifrei Torah Safe, Aron Kodesh. We master plan sites. So you have hardscapes, softscapes, play spaces.
I am overwhelmed just listening to this.
outdoor classrooms. Then you throw in low voltage and AV, IT, right?
And
you throw
that in. People simply don't realize this list.
They don't know. No,
you don't know what you don't know.
So it happens to be what Jonah is experiencing. Every potential client, or even once they're a client of ours, first meeting, they're like, what? Yeah. Like, this is what I have to do to get on a project. And even on related to Jonah is that we design with donors in mind. Should be a tagline.
There you go. put it on a bumper sticker.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, we make sure in a lobby that there's no fire strobes or fire extinguishers or water fountains or outlets right where you want to put your donor signage. Right. It's very important. There are times that people design a building, gorgeous, beautiful, and then they just slap on the donor on the wall.
Right.
And like it's over your fancy stone. It's squeezed in between windows or in a lobby. It's like you have a gorgeous design and then there's a fire strip right like by that letter over there. And then it's right through.
I've seen it. I've seen it. So many. I walk up, like, I go to the executive. I'm like, that's just temporary, right?
so having all that. And then another thing that comes into play is that the payments, we've been on projects, we've been pulled in that they got the drawings and like, I guess it's okay. And they're like, they got the invoice. I guess it's okay. I'll pay him. And then we come in, he's, you know, you overpaid. Like he gave you this level, whatever the professional is. And everyone has good intentions. No one's being malicious here, but the architect saying, you said it was okay. So I invoiced you, but then also, maybe they invoiced a little too much or they're a little ahead of the game because they know they're in the middle of something else that they're about to submit. So sometimes people overpay way before they need it. So having the executive director, the donors, the bank, the parents, the board, knowing that someone is watching on the design side and the financial side and the owner's rep side and the programming side brings all this confidence that they did not have before.
Jeez. I need a nap after that. That was incredible.
Now, by the way, this ties into something that we touched on earlier in the show, but it's important to just come at it one more time. A yeshiva, an organization, they're about to build and to dive into a major capital campaign.
Yes.
The number, they come at it, it comes at it a little bit out of the hat, $25 million, $10 million, whatever. It's ambitious. What are some of the steps? I mean, you know, a few minutes ago, Yossi ran through it, but just really like want to come at this that people watching the show, because like, well, okay, I'm about to launch a major campaign. I'm so glad that Yossi Fischler, Jonah Halper are sharing. What are some of the things that they need to be mindful before they come up with that magic number?
Before they set the campaign
goal? Before they set the campaign goal. There's no question that Yossi, probably them sitting down, drawing out, remember, when a yeshiva, let's say a yeshiva, a day school, when they're going into it, lechatchila, right, ideally, they should build it out to the maximum dream that they have in mind, right? The amount of classrooms, the projection, everything. And then, of course, reality sets in. Because once the campaign launches, you're putting that number to the campaign. You're putting, it's an $18 million campaign. It's a $36 million campaign. And then that's your number you're running with. To give guidance to an organization for coming up with that magic number, what would be your advice?
Okay, I'll take lead on that. And you
I have
chime
some
in.
Thoughts, but yeah, but mine's on the, yeah.
So I said programmatic design, which gets your programming in, but there is also understanding the cost of a project. So most people think the building, they think the construction, and then I have to hire one or two design people. It's really not like that. There's a lot of, they're called soft costs. There's hard costs and soft costs. Hard costs are the construction, and then there's soft costs. Soft costs is all the architects, the attorneys, the variants, the filing fees. People don't even think about filing fees. There's grant fees, right? If you're applying for grants, right. There's, you know, something that falls into donors is the donor signage cost, not the donor where we're placing it or designing it, but the actual cost of the donor signage.
You don't want that coming out of your operating budget.
Correct.
You need to run your school or you're in your school.
Yeah. Right. So people think, okay, I have signage in there, and they're thinking building signage, regulation signage, wayfinding signage, but not the donor signage. So if a donor wants a fancy design of the building,
and they're entitled.
Right. Other things are, let's say, and Rabbi Kramer, great person at South Shore. So one thing he always says, because there's two parts. He always says that Baruch Hashem, we brought up his hasagas of what a project should look like from a master planning perspective. I mean, don't think just building or don't think just function. Think the whole thing. So one thing he always mentions is that, Yossi, I'm so happy, not only because I'm happy, he's happy himself, but because everyone that pulls up to the school, the landscaping, it's the finished item, right? You do this gorgeous building, but the finished item, having that landscaping, especially every season, we're in New York, but in Florida, it's all the time. But that finished product that you have the signage correct, you have the function correct, and then you have this gorgeous landscaping that blooms every year with lighting on at night. So yes, it's a cost, but it brings prestige, right? So there's a lot that you have to think about, not when a person's doing a capital campaign project, not to think just building. There's soft costs to it. There's also another part that when they think of building, they think a contractor doesn't always put in some items like FF&E. And how that's explained is that if you turn over a building and shake it, everything that falls out, right? it's explained like that. It doesn't cover everything. But for example, all the furniture, number one.
Well, we're not planning for Sedim here.
Right. You know, but all the, you know.
It's a good visual though.
Right.
It's a good visual.
And this applies to a shul also the same way. All the furniture, a lot of people don't have a sefer Torah, safe cost in there. They don't have the peroches and the and the bima in there. They don't have smart boards, whiteboards, cork boards. They don't have, we said donor signage, but they don't have all the low voltage that's part of it. They don't have a lot of different items that is still part of the project and you can't move in without it. So it's very important to think of the whole project, and we break it down for a client. We really break down everything. And it's something interesting, even with the marketing, is when we go to a client and they're starting to think, you know, for donors, for funding campaigns and everything. And we're building a new building. And I go, look at your old building. See that logo? It's from 50 years ago.
Right. It's time for a rebrand.
Right. There's something I tell clients all the time, especially for teachers that like hoard too much, like they save every type of project they've ever done or things like that. I say, you're doing crazy change now. You're building a building. People are moving. They're going to be displaced. Parents are going to be picking up from there. Kids are, now is the time to do all the change, like really rip it up.
Clean house.
So if you want to change logos, you want to give teachers different type of storage, you want to change schedules, you want to do everything, they're changing anyways. There's an upheaval anyways, obviously for the good. There's an upheaval. Throw that all in there.
Do it now.
Right. So I tell clients, you're going to bottom line marketing for a marketing world. You're going to Jonah. He has to present what you're preparing. So if you're preparing something that has an old logo or old marketing, old pictures, it doesn't look good. And then also by the time it comes full circle to me and we want to put logos and donor signage, you want something that is nice. You don't want to put an old logo on a new building.
If I could share a story that kind of discusses the interface between what the donor's priorities are and what the project ends up looking like. We have a client that at the really beginning of the engagement, I think even before they even signed on the dotted line, they said, well, we have this donor right now. Like, just, you know, give us some advice right now, where it's a woman who came to us as what we're doing a new building for a new campus for our school. And she would like to dedicate the handicap accessibility. Oh, that's interesting, right? Like, you don't hear that every day. So I don't have to donate the handicap accessibility. Like, there must be a story there. And he was telling me, the development professional was telling me that, you know, that I did my homework and I asked somebody who knew her. And she said, oh, you mean Rachel, Bas, Miriam, whoever it is. And they said, and by saying that, he realized that, oh, there must have been some health crisis that she was dealing with. And that's why her Hebrew name was just top of mind. Right. And he knew that this was obviously a passion project because something that happened in her life and handicap accessibility was important to her. So this development professional was telling me that they were going to get a letter from the Rosh Yeshiva, a nice message about the you know, connecting the handicap accessibility to the priorities of the yeshiva, blah, 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 blah. My nice cover letter with the pitch and to ask her to dedicate a ramp to go up the middle, to go up like, you mm-hmm. know, the side of the building. Mm-hmm. And then I said to him, I said, well, there's one step you didn't do yet. And he said, what is that? I said, well, did you have a meeting with her and say, hey, you want to dedicate the handicap accessibility? It's, you know, more of an unconventional ask. I'm curious to know, like, why is this your thing? Ask her, why is this your thing? If she's comfortable sharing, she'll share. If she's not comfortable, she won't share. But let's say, I said, for the sake of argument, let's say you ask her, why is it that this is the project you're interested in? And she comes to you and says, when I was a girl, you know, I was handicapped and I felt like a second class citizen because they would, like, you know, they'd like put me up the ramp through the side of the building. And I didn't feel like all the other girls who went right up the main threshold right into the building. So I said, well, that changes the ask you're going to make in a very meaningful way. If you go to her and just say, we have handicap accessibility, would you support it? You might get some money. But if you say in the narrative that we want every child to feel like this is their organization, this their school, and not feel like a schlepper on the side of the building. And also, where's that handicap ramp going? Is it going up the side of the building or is it going right up the middle, right? Saying this, you're like every other child, right? So these are very important conversations to have to find out the why of what a donor wants to dedicate. And it's not just a vanity project for everybody. Sometimes they want the kitchen. I've had a donor for one of our schools that said, I want to dedicate the kitchen. Why the kitchen? My father loved to cook. Okay. And as you start understanding more about their father and what the father liked to cook, and he was, you know, loved sourdough and loved baking sourdough. You don't think that we were thinking how to incorporate those themes into the dedication of a kitchen. Those are very, very important, not to keep things superficial, but to understand motivations for donors, what they want to give and the real world implications that it can have on the project. Doesn't mean like, look, yes, you might come back and say, you're a crazy person for wanting to put the ramp right up the middle. Maybe that's not tenable and we have to deal with it. At least the narrative can change about what you're trying to accomplish. But these are things that are real world consequences of having these conversations with donors and what it can mean for a project.
So I want to add to what Jonah said, because he brought up a very valid point regarding, we were talking before about people limiting their campaigns because they don't know what they could actually raise. So in design, when we're designing a building, I come across it from a different perspective. And along the lines of what you said about sponsoring ADA access. So back to South Shore for a second, right? Because it just, we spent a lot of time there. I'm already on my fifth project with Rabbi Kramer. So we've been through a lot. Yes. Right. With more to come. So it's very interesting because back to the landscaping for a second. So it's like, oh, it's a lot of money. I don't know. But then there was one person that saw it and was like, I loved it. And he sponsored it. And then there was a side strip by their building. And I wanted to do a playground, lower level playground, meaning age wise. And we did winding rubber road and we did, you know, certain types of items, not complicated. And he's like, I don't know. It's a lot of money. How am I going to get it sponsored? In the end, someone sponsored it. And it had to do with October 7th and everything. It was a whole thing. And the person sponsored it. So one thing that Jonah sells and I sell from a different perspective is if you limit your design because either your hasagas for what you could raise are low, or you limit your design because you don't think that you could actually get it donated, right? Who thought an ADA ramp could be donated? I always push when, so we prepare a donor sheet for Jonah, for, you know, type or the client that we prepared, just like we design, we split buildings for different wings and we create headers for donors in design. So we're designing for the donor as well, not for only the function.
Right.
We also prepare a spreadsheet of all those opportunities. And sometimes we get feedback like, you put that on there, no one's ever going to donate that. And I'm like, wait and see. Yeah. If someone doesn't donate, it's something that we could pull out. Okay,
well, and they can come to me, and I can show them comps of what is typically donated. Or we have that. We have that the 20,000 foot view to say this can be, or we've never seen it, but like you said, like let's give it a shot. Why can't you can have stuff that doesn't sell in a capital campaign?
Correct.
Something can go 4 years. That kitchen that I mentioned before that was dedicated by someone because their father. That happened like 3-4 years after the campaign.
And they had to put the kitchen in anyways.
Correct.
Because they needed a kitchen.
You need a kitchen. But it was like something that was a specific thing that they wanted. It doesn't have to go right in prime time. It can go whenever it is.
Right. So I always tell people, let's design. Now, obviously design with a budget. We have everyone has constraints and everything. But don't hold back on something that could be amazing just because you think at this point you won't get a donor. If you do get a donor, then yes, we'll execute on it if it's easily to pull out. Certain things just talk to people differently. I'm like that also. I'd rather, instead of giving $1 million, I'd rather sponsor a specific thing because it feels better. I mean, I'm not the one to have a name on a building. It's not my thing, but I understand it and respect it. But specific items are very important not to poo-poo it and say, whatever, we're not going to put it on the list.
Yeah. Literally 1 week ago, we have a client right now that's doing a campus, and the executive director mentioned to me almost offhanded saying, you know, we're going to make this outside really nice. I'm like, obviously my antennas go up. I'm like, well, what are you doing to dedication? He said, well, it's the yard, the courtyard, mm-hmm. It's like a real great place for our boys and to be able to be there and have a good time. And we have a donor that he was telling me just like minutes before who was notorious is like a negative thing, but was famous for having community people in their yard all the time, like their yard, like their house was like the place where all the kids came to play, and they were moving out of the community, and it was like the last opportunity to come to them out of Hakkar Satov. Their kids went to the school. You know, would you support this thing? And I said to him, why don't you go to them? And I'll, for the sake of the story, I'll change the name and say we want to dedicate this yard and call it the Goldberg's backyard, at the school. It's awesome. Right. And they made the ask. It was a $250,000 pledge.
It's amazing.
Because they said something that was relevant to them. It was a legacy piece for them because they were moving out of the community and their yard was the backyard. And now it's called the backyard at the school. It's the so Goldberg's precious. Backyard at the school in perpetuity.
I'm going to bring up two other projects of the same thing that came up recently, totally out of left field. Cemeteries. Mm. Still,
I've never done one, so this is all you.
So it's still a nonprofit. It's an organization. Right. Actually, they do a lot of chesed, and there's a lot of they don't charge people.
The end user doesn't complain though. That's it.
So we've been talking to them about they want to renovate the building that they have, and I noticed, I was like, there's no donor signage anything here. There's no, I mean. Maybe they solicit and they get, I'm sure they do, but I was like, there's no presentation that when people come, I said, it's such an honorable thing, Chesed Shalem, as whether you're helping out. Let's say you want to sponsor for the person that does the Chesed Shalem, right? There's so many opportunities there. And I was very surprised that they didn't take the opportunity. It's not only to solicit people. People want to give. They want right. to help out.
To be involved.
And I was very surprised, and maybe we'll do it together. Very surprised that, and not only for that, a week later, a different cemetery called me, just no connection whatsoever. It was just very odd that they came up. But you never know what type of project it is, and you just shouldn't limit what you think you could get or cut out, because you just never know what someone has a passion, they have a backstory, and therefore it'll elevate your design.
You know the expression, right? Time flies when you're having fun.
Yes.
We are basically out of time, but we're going to get in another 3 minutes. Maybe each of you could share. Now, first of all, by the way, Jonah just came out with a new release. We want to hear a little bit about your new book. And Yossi, if you could just share.
I'm coming out with a book soon. Maybe okay. A few years. No, I didn't start yet, but
it's going to happen.
I got to compete
here. It's going to happen. But as we approach, and of course, this incredible show, The Capital Campaign Playbook with Yossi Fischler, founder of Consult, and Jonah Halper, president of Altruicity. Again, thank you so much for schlepping out from wherever you are, from your locations. Of course, from Eretz Yisrael, it's a bigger trip than the five towns, but it's nonetheless everyone, you know, that came out in order to share this incredible content with organizations of any size. And this, we shared so much information, but perhaps a tip, something you could share. It could be from the new book. We'd love to hear about it, the name of it. And Yossi, some takeaway as we close out the show. First, we're going to jump.
All right. So, I have a new book coming out in. Well, I don't know when the podcast.
Well,
will
I'm
issue.
Saying it's going to be out.
It's almost out. It's almost out. The book is called Magnetic Mission. So it's got some good alliteration to it. Yes. The premise of the book is that we are very conditioned to experience fundraising as something like you're chasing your donors, right? Like, I need this as a fundraiser. I need your money in order to accomplish my mission. And that desperation comes through in every interaction that you have with your donors. And it's actually not the way, if you look outside of especially our from or religious world, it's not how fundraising is done. If you were to go to a university setting or a hospital setting, there's none of this desperation of running around saying, can you give to my campaign? And we have 10,000 things that we're giving to every year. I mean, we have our religion is built in with my Meiser and Kimcha de Pischa, Matanas Lavionim, 18,000 crowdfunding campaigns. So there's no shortage of stuff coming through, but the way fundraising needs to be done is more of a function of looking for the alignment. And what do I mean by that? You know, it's the idea of a magnetized pole. Like, let's say you have the North Pole and we're magnetized towards that. So I know if I'm a school that I have certain priorities. I care about academic excellence. I know it could be on a Torah level. It could be on general studies level. I know that the example from the school I mentioned before, love of Eretz Yisrael, that's a priority. And the third one might be midos, character development. Right. So if I know those are my priorities and I go meet with somebody who sits right next to me in shul and is worth $1 billion and they're interested in saving the whales, right? Probably not the best prospect,
right?
Even though they sit next to me in shul, right? However, if I know there's somebody in the community who I don't know yet, doesn't know my school yet, but they're a big supporter of Magen David Adom and the FIDF, and I go to them and say, hey, I would love to hear about your giving, why you give to what you give to. I know you give to a lot of Israel causes. We are a school that Israel is a very big piece of who we are, and I'd love to learn about your giving. Now it's relevant. And as I listen, and first of all, what's the major dynamic shift right here is that instead of me as a fundraiser going in and vomiting up every single program and service that I have to offer, we do this, 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 we do this. And then at the end, hopefully something stuck. And then I'll say, would you give to our campaign? I'm listening. 80% of my conversation is them talking and sharing what they love, why they give to Israel. I'm always asking why is that your thing? Why do you care about that? And when I understand that, then I can follow up with them. I go back to my office instead of going, what should I do with this guy? What's my next step? No. Now I can, like, he told me plenty of information. I could say, hey, you know what? We have a Yomats Moot Parade coming up. Or we might say to them, you know, take a look at this WhatsApp video I just sending you. The first grade is doing a gym class with a giant floor map of Israel, and the kids have to run from Haifa to Tveria to Tveria to Eilat. And so it's like a gym thing. And what you're showing is you're not just paying lip service to the idea that, oh, we love Israel. Look, it rolls up all the touch points I'm giving you roll up to the mission of what we're doing. So instead of just going giving someone a cheesecake for Shavuos or going out for them for coffee, which might be general engagement and just develops a stronger connection with you as a person, you're giving them things that are rolling up to the things that they care about. You're scratching the donor's itch. It's not, I need this. Right. You're removing this ration and saying, I'm giving you the thing that you want and the thing that you love. So the book that I have coming out operates under that premise. And therefore, like the stories that we've been sharing today on this podcast about, like, for example, saying, I know that you love having children in your backyard and that all your chayes, all the things that you love is from that experience. And we want to make that in perpetuity and give a place for the kids to have that forever. You're addressing what they care about, what they love, and making it about what about them. If you do anything otherwise, if it's all about what you're treating your donor like an ATM machine. You're going to them for a withdrawal, right? And you say, thank you very much for your gift. And you come back to them 1 year later, if it's annual campaign and, you know, whatever the case may be, but you're not setting yourself up for long-term relationships and success.
Amazing. Yossi.
Okay. So the first thing I want to say is that I deal with a lot of board members, executive directors, presidents, all different types of people in the nonprofit world, not-for-profit world, either one. It's very important that I give a shout out to them and truly thank them because they put so much effort and so much time into these projects. And I see it firsthand. And they don't get paid and it's day and night. And whether they put their money in it or not, separate discussion, but they work hard. And there are times that there's contentious, you know, like it doesn't work well. I miss something. They miss something, you know, you're right. Bumps in the road. Exactly. But at the end of the day, we all want the end result. I have kids in school. I want my school to be great. I go to shul. I want my shul to be great. You know, things like that. It's very important to recognize all the effort that they put in to make things happen. Now, on the other flip side is that I've been president of Beis Tefillah of Inwood for the last 3 years. And I've also been a board member of Inwood Mikvah in the five towns, the shuls in the five towns also. And I helped with construction, but also I've seen their side. I've seen their side. I've gotten the complaints. I've gotten, why are we doing this? Why are we not doing this? I've had to answer to a lot of people. I understand their side. That's a little different that we have. And my shul is very large. We have an event space. We have over 200 member families. We have a million things flying all the time. It's Grand Central. So therefore, it's not only that we're looking at it from a design perspective that we're coming in as a design person and helping you out. We're living your life also. As a president, I have board members that I have to answer to. I have a rav that I have to speak to. I have members that I have to get back to. There's timelines. Yes, no one can do everything. There's sequencing. You need money. You need, you know, a shul has a little less pressure than a school to move things along because people fit. So someone might have to switch seats here and there. It's not like you don't have room for a class, right? Or no room for resource enrichment or other stuff. So it's a little different, but we're living it, right? So we bring that expertise to have both sides and make sure a project is thought through from their perspective, from the front function perspective, the money perspective, the design perspective, and really pull it together to get the end result that there's no coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Love it.
What an amazing show, the Capital Campaign Playbook. We certainly hope that this helps your shul, your organization, your capital campaign in a major way. Of course, feel free to leave comments in the comment section below. Special thank you to Yossi Fischler of Consult, Jonah Halper of Altruicity. By the way, how could people find out more information about Consult?
So first of all, thank you for pronouncing correctly. It's Consult, not Consult, but I get both, and technically we do both. But it's Consult without the vowels. So it's CNSLTGRP.com. So it's Group without the vowels and Consult without the vowels.
And Jonah, your website.
I have lots of owls in mind.
Altruicity.
Altruicity. So it's kind of the combination of altruism and city. So it's altruicity.com. And that's where you can find us. Everything's there.
And of course, we wish everyone great hatzlacha and all their big vision picture projects.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having
us. Very special. Thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Your Business. Please subscribe to the channel so you'll automatically be informed when the next episode goes live. See you in the next episode.